Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information.
I have a very special guest with me from Oregon, a power couple that I've known for a while now. We have Daniel, who's a state rep in Oregon, and we have his wife, Catherine, who's a business person in Oregon. And today, both of them are going to share their path and their journey with me as they are on their way to this Asian Hall of Fame. So welcome both of you to the podcast today.
Thanks, Ken, for having us.
Thank you, Ken, for having us this morning.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all of.
I struggled with how to approach the interview because there's so much story in between the two of you. But let me start, I think, with Catherine. Can you tell me, and then Daniel, I'd like to hear yours as well, but can you tell me how you got started out in business?
The business started with Daniel and his family back in the late 70s from his mom selling at the street fair. And later in life that he joined his parents opening the first restaurant in downtown Seattle. And that was when we were at the time was just dating.
And we were engaged.
We were about engaged. Mm-hmm. And a year later, we got married. And that was when I got also involved in the restaurant, learning the restaurant industry from the ground, from the kitchen. And I think later the industry found my leadership really involved in managing the staff, tenants, vendors, planning the forecast, projections, the marketing. I mean, me and Daniel wear all hats in the restaurant to make it successful because owning a restaurant from the early days are hard business.
Yeah. So, Catherine, you just basically walked on the team not knowing business at all, yet no experience.
I wouldn't say that. You've always been this, this hustler, this woman, entrepreneur. You've always had that part. I think that sometimes you often kind of gloss over that, but I think that really you've always been known as, a deal maker.
Well, back when I was very young, right? I always tell my mom, I want to help with the family, do the grocery. So, you know, how we go to in Vietnam, we'll go shopping, grocery shopping every morning for the family. And I always raise my hand, you know, I want to do it, mom. And I think probably at the age 5 or 6 years old, I start doing that. And I think the joy of it is the bargaining. I would bargain everything, Kenny. I think that's including, you know, just a bunch of cilantro or onions. Green onions are cheap, but I still bargain. And the lady just keeps saying, oh my gosh, you know, she's the toughest bargainer. But I think that's really the drive me of sparked me the idea of, you know, being an entrepreneur at a very, very young age. And I remember my mom would come back and say, as soon as you can talk, you said that one day I will become a woman entrepreneur and determined. I mean, everything I do from since then, I would involve anything negotiating or business or involving people, right? And then that kind of followed me. And so when I get into the restaurant, of course, I, you know, take over the ordering, take over the scheduling, take over the planning. And that's how I got involved in the business and kind of over years master the skills.
I can imagine, you know, from a cultural perspective, since we're talking about the Asian Hall of Fame and you walking on the team of your in-laws, right? Your, you know, Daniel's mother. How did that all work out? Was it easy in the beginning?
I wouldn't call it easy, but I think focusing on what's important, I think that's, you know, our relationship was important to me. And also we have a responsibility, not just for our family, but our staff and our customer and our landlord. So a lot of time, I mean, you can imagine in the Vietnamese family, when you work and live together practically 24/7 with your newlywed husband, and also the in-laws families, you know, I have to say those challenging, definitely very difficult, but I just focus on, you know, the priorities, the duties, and also what's important to you. And that was what happened.
Well, certainly mom and dad didn't make it easy, right? I think that she reminded, you know, oftentimes we forget now, but when we first opened the restaurant, she was married into the family, married into the business, and that required, you know, 24/7, eat, drink, sleep, restaurant, then rinse and repeat again. So we were working at the restaurant, both me and Catherine and my mom and dad, and we shared the same house too. So there was no escape. And so
I would say this, my whole, you know, young early life about negotiating, mastering my skills, but sometimes I jokingly telling Daniel, I failed when you proposed. I didn't agree to get into the business, work in the business, right? But, you know, and now looking back, I think that's really getting us to know each other really fast, at a faster pace, but also requiring us to really, when we say, we usually say, right? So that was always grained in my head. Every time we struggles, facing a challenge, I'm saying, you know, we'll just keep remember that and help me through those hard days.
We've been together as business partners as long as we have been as a married couple. So it's kind of always been what we've only known, right? Both being in business and being in a married relationship with each other. So
I'll make a quick jump over to Daniel and the decision as a team to run for office, Oregon State Representative. Can we talk about that journey?
Sure. Gosh, you know, certainly getting into politics is not something that I don't think that was even a possibility. And it's not something I dreamed about. I'm going to be involved in politics someday. It was just never something we ever thought about. But I think it was really when, you know, as we had our, you know, at that time we had our two kids, two daughters, you know, young family. And we're starting to think about, gosh, what's going to be, you know, we're starting to become more aware of what's around us, right? And I think as young people, we often are so focused on, you know, just what's directly in front of you. But I think as we have families, we, you know, there's this natural process where we start to become more aware of what's going on around us. And that, as I start to become a little bit more mature and just understanding that there's a lot of things that are happening around us that we should speak up about. I think there was really some things, there was some injustices that were happening around us. And I think it's something that, you know, up until that point, you know, we as Vietnamese Americans oftentimes just accepted it was just a fact of life. Right? We're here as just visitors or as temporary guests of America, right? And there's, you know, even my parents always thought, you know, that we have to make sure that, you know, we're good guests, we're good house guests to America, right? So that also meant that, well, yeah, we kind of suck it up at the time we didn't really internalize it that way, but, you know, we were the subject of a lot of prejudice and racism, but we just kind of chalked it up. Oh, it's just suck it up. It's just part of being, you know, being an outsider in the American society. So I think it was really when, beginning in about 2016, when, you know, I started kind of listen to what the political rhetoric was around us, and what really kind of stuck in my mind at the time, this in 2016, there was a local race here in Oregon. It was a Senate race. And there was a candidate that was running for U.S. Senator. And he had brought up, he was in an interview, candidate interview. It was a public interview. It was on the radio, publicized. And the question was asked of the candidate, so what would you do about the Syrian refugee crisis? And his response was, well, Oregon has seen this type of crisis before. When the Vietnamese refugees came to Oregon, we had a similar problem. They couldn't assimilate to the American society. So when it got cold, they didn't know what to do. So they would light fires in their apartments that the government provided to them. When they needed food, they resorted to their native means and would hunt the neighborhood cats and dogs, which was what we were hearing. This is not a new thing. This is something that has been recurring over and over again. And so when I heard those comments most recently, I just brought back all these memories. And those are the kind of things when I brought it up to some of, you know, my friends that were in church and were also had parents of young kids too. And I brought it up and I said, guys, can you believe this? They're talking about our Vietnamese refugee community like this. Can you believe that? And it was like, I was so in shock and I was so upset. And they were like, we don't pay attention to that. That's just talk. It's nothing real. And so, anyway, I found it really frustrating because to get my fellow Vietnamese Americans to really think about that way, that's an attack against us. And so that's kind of what I'm feeling. There's got to be something more. We've got to be able to be involved. And that's where I thought, you know, we can yell and scream and we can stomp our feet. We can pound on the doors, but if we're on the outside, we can't change anything. And so those were kind of the beginning seeds of when I wanted to be much more involved in politics, right? Because I'd seen it growing up. My parents, when my mom had a food stand at the local food market, right? You know, her English wasn't great. We were selling at the time, our sign on our food stand said Oriental food. And so all of a sudden you've got people selling hot dogs and hamburgers and nachos and cotton candy. Then you have a booth selling Oriental food. So you always got the worst spot in the whole lineup. They always push us in the back.
Yeah.
They always, you know, we're out of the way. And so there were many times my mom said, you know, it's because we don't speak good English. It's because we can't speak up for ourselves, that we can't advocate. Well, God, we've been here for all these years, then we should have some seniority. But it was always like people selling, you know, American fare, the hamburgers and hot dogs that got all the prime spots, right? And we were left with the bad spot, unless we started to really fight back and really kind of show that, you know, that we deserve to be here just like everybody else. And I watched my mom and I watched my older brother, especially my oldest brother. He would he came down one day to help set up the booth, and he was coming back from work and he was all sweaty. He had these rip-off t-shirt sleeves, and my older brothers, they were into bodybuilding, so he was built. And so he came down and he basically told the organizer of the street fair, we've been here this long, we need to have this spot, you're going to do this. And so we got the booth moved, and the guy was scared of my brother, because he spoke English and he was he looked like he could beat him up. But those are the kind of experiences I kind of started to see, that, you know, unless we, you know, speak up, unless we are involved, unless we are a part of the decision-making process, we're going to get neglected. We're going to get overlooked. And so those are kind of the early seeds of thinking about how do we get involved. And I didn't really know how to get involved in politics. So that's, you know, kind of a long about way about how I got what started, but I really started to get involved in when I moved to Lake Oswego. This is where I became a city councilor first, and understanding about how to run a local campaign and get elected. And at that time, I was the first person of color ever elected in the city. And so, just quite a shock to go through that process and then get on the dais and being actually in the council chambers and making decisions. And so, yeah.
You know, Oregon is very fascinating to me from a perspective of the amount of Vietnamese representation it's incredible. There's five of you, right? That is in the state representative category. You guys are, you know, there's five elected officials, and it's a very white American state. And I think that in other locales in the United States, there's a lot of Vietnamese, but not like the kind of representation that, what do you think attributes to that much leadership as it relates to Vietnamese people in Oregon?
I think we've got a bad connection. We're kind of choppy. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Did you get that question?
I got the question. Yeah, okay. I was kind of freezing up. You know, I think a lot about that too. What makes Oregon unique in that way? Because, you know, our population is not near the size of California or other states or Texas or where there's large pockets. But I just think a lot about, I look at some of my colleagues. We're all very different. We all have different professions. We all grew up in different parts of the country. I grew up here in the Pacific Northwest. But I think that one of the things I think we realize here is that we don't have kind of these enclaves where we live and we work and we socialize as Vietnamese Americans. And so we're kind of forced to assimilate with wherever we live, right? And so I think it's just something where I think by us recognizing that when we are elected to serve the community, we are not representing just our own communities. We represent the district. The districts in Oregon are about 70 to 80,000 people, and they're not all Vietnamese. They're not all white either, right? And so we recognize that when the communities want to elect us and to represent the district, represent the community, we have to be able to speak to everyone. We have to be able to show the represent the wider community. And I think that sometimes, you know, my theory potentially is that sometimes we get in these bubbles, and sometimes our what we understand as our problems may not be the same problems that are important to other community members. They might not be the same issues that resonate with different communities. And so I think by being in very non-Vietnamese or non-Asian communities, it kind of forces us to think about think more broadly beyond our own experience. I think that's maybe led to some of the successes we've had and be able to win elected office in five different districts in the state of Oregon, which is, by the way, there's 60 districts in the whole state. Holding five seats we're overrepresented as Vietnamese Americans in the state house.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. It's a phenomenal position. Now, I was in Portland a few days ago, and walking through the airport, I was like, oh my God, there's Bambuza. There is the company. There is the restaurant that you guys are at the airport. And it was such an impressive feeling for me to have that Vietnamese representation. Can you tell me a little bit, Catherine, how that all happened?
Well, I think before I answer your questions, let me take you back of how we get in the airport and how we involved in and have a restaurant at the airport. I think back when we moved from Seattle to Portland, back home, Oregon, that was 2006,
seven.
2007. And we first opened our restaurant in South Waterfront District. And as you know, following years, 2008, 2009 was the Great Recession. So it was the worst time to open any business. So
especially restaurants,
right? In 2010, we got the news. We expected a new baby, so we overjoyed. But then, just a few weeks later, we also know it will be a difficult pregnancy. So things changed, plans changed, everything changed, has changed. So after a couple of years later, 2012, Daniel and I decided to go back to get our master's degree, MBA, with the idea of exiting the industry and let's get a real job, right? So we were staggered Daniel, go first, because at the time I was nursing the baby. I mean, it was just like, you know, one of us have to continue the business to be able to pay for the tuition. So we kind of staggered. In 2014, Port of Portland dropped us a package at our site.
That was 2013.
The airport did
an outreach. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Did the outreach, drop us the package. So we had come to the outreach and learn about the opportunity. And so 2014, we prepared the RFP. It's a request for a proposal, right? So Daniel and I, we basically put our MBA to work to see, okay, we spend, you know, we invest this much of money and time. Is it really, you know, working?
So by that time, both of you had finished the MBA programs?
He finished it. I about to complete mine. So that was, and I used Chipotle case as my capstone. So we paid pretty much mimicking the RFP, right? So we wrote the RFP. It was hard. It was long. But I think during the process, writing, preparing the RFP really forces us to reflect why we do things that we're doing, right? Why we do what we do. And because they're in there, there is vision, there's missions, you know, the projections, workforce, you know, all of that, that require really honing, like, why are we doing this? Why do we want to do this? So we submitted the RFP, we won. And we're like, wow, we actually have a contract with the government. Not a typical leases like with the other landlord on the street side, right? So we felt something different and special. I don't know how to describe.
When we went to the outreach, the meeting they had, it was we thought we walked in the wrong building, because they had an outreach meeting at a hotel lobby and a hotel ballroom. There were hundreds of people there. Yeah. Nobody that was there.
Hard to land these contracts.
Yeah, well, they were there with all in suits and pulling carry-on baggage. And I thought, wait, this must be some conference for some other professional organization. So, no, this is the right place. This is the informational session, the outreach for food and beverage contracts coming up at the airport. And so, I mean, we walked in with our you know, restaurant clothes, thinking, hey, it's a restaurant outreach. You know, we wear restaurant clothes, right? So we were definitely out of place, but
for sure. Yeah. We thought we're like two kids. What are we doing here? Yeah. We almost walk out of the room, but the staff say, hey, just sit it through. Anyhow, long story short, we won, and then we quickly attended weekly meetings. They walk us through what they needed.
Can I stop you there? What do you think was in that RFP package that allowed you to win the contract?
I mean, certainly the airport was very clear that they wanted, you know, a local business. They wanted small business. They were making a very concerted effort to be able to open up these typically opportunities that were really reserved for big multinational companies. The airport here in Portland made a concerted effort to make sure that we are bringing prosperity to the local communities, creating wealth in the community and keeping it here. And I think that they really were looking for brands, cuisines that really reflected the local Portland food scene, right? Mm-hmm. People, instead of just having typical, you know, airport food, you know, they wanted to have something that was very much a local flavor of Portland. And I think that was, and it allowed Portland, the Portland Airport in particular, to for many years in a row, to win Nation's Best Airport. Mm-hmm. And the food and beverage program was a huge part of that success. Yeah. And so I think that it was a matter of timing. I think that the airport had done this outreach. We were, an emerging, we're a brand where, you know, we were still trying our own identity. We were thinking, gosh, the whole idea was of doing the MBA was to exit the industry altogether. But then
we didn't know that was prepping us for the RFP, right? Well, again, but I think that's the airport at the time wanted to create a sense of place. And one, their goal is to make sure the community thrive and, you know, creating generational wealth opportunity for local small businesses. But that's how we got in.
Yeah, that's a very intentional part of Portland and the government of Portland. And I think it's reflecting sort of like the mindset of a community like Portland. And now that you, Daniel, are in that sort of that world of making things, you know, in the government, can you tell me that how I'm curious about how intentional you can be at the government level and implement changes that affect Asian Americans in Oregon?
Mm. Well, you know, certainly when I was running for my seat in the state house, you know, I really drew upon my experience as a small business owner. And I also shared a lot about my experiences as, you know, as a son of immigrants, right? Many immigrants that when they come to this country, they, you know, the way for them to provide for our families was to start a small business, right? Typically, it's they tend to be congregated in the areas of food service, in the service industries, right? A lot of, you know, a lot of manual labor type jobs, right? So I recognize that, you know, in my experience, and really recognizing that, you know, economic opportunity creates the opportunity for advancement in society, right? And quite frankly, to be in politics, I think that, you know, for us to have standing in politics is sometimes it really requires us to be able to, how do you ascend into the middle class? And I think that for immigrant communities, entrepreneurship is that pathway to get into the middle class. And so I recognize that, and now I chair the Economic Development and Small Business and Trade Committee. And so I take that experience, I take that that thinking with me as I think about how do we continue to create opportunities, like when the Port of Portland, as a government agency, decided that we are going to be able to be intentional about creating pathways for people to grow their business, to provide opportunities for their communities. I mean, Ken, when I walk through the airport and I see people that are like my mom's age, people that don't that just came over here not too long ago, and for them to be able to walk through the airport with a security badge on a lanyard, wow, straight to the TSA in front of the line, show their badge, do their fingerprint, walk straight through, and have them walk to work, it gives them a sense of pride that it's just something that we feel like we can provide this for our communities. This is generational change. This is, you know, creating that generational wealth. And it's because of that that, you know, we're able to provide jobs that are out of the shadows. They're not restaurant jobs where we pay people under the table. They're jobs that we provide, you know, stable income that they can actually verify when they go apply for a mortgage, right? They're able to use their pay stubs to be able to sponsor their families from other countries to come to live with them. They're able to send their kids to college, right? And so we recognize that economic opportunity opens up so many doors for folks. And that's when I think about being involved at the policy level, that's what I'm focused on a lot, is think about how do we replicate those successes so our community can make sure that we have a chance of really achieving this American dream, right? And there's a lot of rhetoric about, well, gosh, it's the American dream is getting farther and farther away. It's hard, but we also have to be intentional about creating that pathway.
Well, I think I mean, you and I also talked about how can we now go through understanding a little bit from our experiences and provide this knowledge in undoing barriers, unintentional barriers, right? And I think that's why Daniel involved in to hope to help create that understanding when decision maker, policy maker make policy. Sometimes just lacking of knowledge or experiences, they're you know, creating barriers.
I think of you both coming from very humble beginnings. But Catherine, when I think about your story, I think you were 13 when you came to the United States, right? Is that right? You were 13?
Yes, correct.
Now, at 13, what were you thinking was going to be your future here in the U.S.?
Well, I mean, I guess probably when I was 13, we got to United States, and before we got to United States, even I think this is heaven. United States is, you know, place of heaven. I dreamed of, you know, drinking Coke every day at every meals, and that what we did when we got here. Every day, every meals, there are Cokes in our dining table, or be able to, you know, wear perfume. I mean, simple things like that. In Vietnam, we don't have that. And I always remember when in Vietnam, fourth grade, fifth grade, we'll go to, you know, school. Once in a very rare opportunity, some of my classmates would say, "This is American apple or American chocolate." So that was kind of in my dream, right? And imagine that's America. And when we got here, we did just that, is to eat as much as American apples, drink as much as Coke, you know. I think that's very typical of 13 years old girl would do, and I did just that. But I think that's today, the 13 years old, it was very different than my time. Of course, we live in a time where our, you know, young girls have access to so much more. The country and the community now so much, you know, has so much prosperities, but also facing a very difficult time than ever. And I think that's all of us, I mean, my time, our girls' time, and many more billions of women out in the world that at one point was, you know, go through a 13 years old, right? 13 years old is the hard age to begin with, right? So I think that's, you know, just knowing, I mean, for me, I have a support group, we call it youth group, at the church that I would go every Friday, Saturday, hang out. But those really kind of platform for support, because I don't get the support of mom at home. My parents was busy working two jobs because we just got to the United States, right? There's no really me and mom time, right? And especially from our Vietnamese culture, we don't close, we don't hug, we don't kiss, we don't say, "I love you." So those are things I would fulfill at by going to a youth group and get those fulfillment. And today I would say, you know, the kids are now have plenty of that from, you know, I mean, I have a 13 years old at home. So I make sure she, you know, she heard me, and then, you know, I care about her. But also I always letting her know, everybody at one point went through at 13 years old. So the support, the systems, the support is out there. Whatever you are questioning or experiencing the difficulties at school or as peers, it will be okay.
When I got the email, the reach out from the folks over at the Asian Hall of Fame, I was like, "Oh, this makes perfect sense." And I was like, "Well, this should have happened a lot sooner, right? For people like, you know, you and Daniel, Catherine." How did this transpire? And what does it mean to both of you to be inducted into the Asian Hall of Fame?
I have to say, first we thought, we felt out of place in the Hall of Fame. Because, you know, we felt like,
yeah, it's typical. We're not athletes. You know? We're not movie stars. We're not musicians, right? That's when we think about the Hall of Fame. That's kind of like the folks that we think about, right?
I think for us, we didn't do things to get recognitions or awards, right? And the first questions was, are we really deserving this award? That was the very first thing that's come up in my mind. But then we later recognized, you know, a lot of other, of course, we had, you know, there are so many more others in the state, in the community, done great work, but they're not being seen or not yet being recognized. So hopefully this is, you know, the first
yeah,
and
the beginning,
and,
I think.
Yeah, the beginning.
I mean, we often think about, Oregon as a state that is really in between California and Washington, right? And sometimes we don't know what there's a strong Asian American community here that's been here for a long time, right? And I recognize maybe this recognition really would help to kind of bring a spotlight on all of the great work that's happening here in Oregon. If we think about that way, we're honored, but again, we're always have this thinking that, you know, there's so many people that have done so much more for the community here that deserve the recognition. So I think it's going to be our goal too now that we've got the attention of the Hall of Fame, to be able to think about, well, what about people that have gone before us? There are people that have been inducted to the Hall of Fame that have since passed. And so I think we're going to be potentially nominating some folks that may have already passed, but that really have made a profound impact on the lives of Asian Americans here in the state of Oregon. So we recognize that this is at least, you know, a chance for us to be able to bring the spotlight, to be able to help tell the stories of others that came before us.
Yeah, when you mention that past people of the Asian Hall of Fame have passed away, it makes me think about this question of legacy. In the next, you know, few decades of your lives, you know, what do you intend on accomplishing?
You know, I think to your point, every award is a call to action, right? It's a duty. And I personally, as a woman, I always coming from a place where I didn't have a lot of role model, right? Growing up, back in our society in Vietnam, girls and women are expected to do house chores, to do housework, and not to get involved in the community or be seen in the leadership role. So I hope that, you know, this award would give me a platform to inspire and to get behind young girls, especially, and Asian American leaders, that, you know, it's great that we are take care of our family and be successful in our profession career, but also to get involved and in our community, because I think that's getting the community, helping the community is the purpose of our life. So I think that I hope to inspire it. And now that I got this platform, I hope to, you know, open the doors and pull others through with me. Again, like I said, this is the beginning, and I feel this is a call to action.
Yeah. And so to answer your question about the legacy too, I think that Catherine spoke a lot about, you know, what she's envisioning, but I think we also recognize too that, you know, as part of a greater legacy, right? It's the legacy that our parents started when immigrant families decided to leave Vietnam and come start new here in the United States, right? And I think it's just recognize that we are just part of this continuum. It's something that they had started, and we're just a part of that. And we also recognize that, you know, it's our duty and our responsibility to be thinking about how do we continue that legacy that people have started before us in search of a better life, in search of more opportunity, in search of freedom. And so I think that's something that, you know, we hope that that through the work that we're doing, that we can inspire others to become more active in that legacy, that the shared legacy that we all have as Vietnamese Americans living here in this country. And so I think it's kind of really our hope too, that we inspire others to continue to live out this legacy that was started before I was born and started by our the previous generations. And so, and I hope that we set a good example for the generations that follow us.
You know, one stark difference between, I think, Oregon business folks of Vietnamese origins in the difference between Southern California and Oregonians, I talk about this quite a bit in the podcast now, is that there's such an openness for the leadership in Oregon to work across the ocean with Vietnam, whether that's private business or whatever enterprise, there just seems to be much more of a willingness to how important is it for Asian Americans or Vietnamese Americans to work with people in Vietnam?
I think it's part of this greater legacy that we were talking about before. I think it's, we recognize that being Vietnamese is not what party we ascribe to, what party we're part of. I think it's, being Vietnamese is so much more than, just government and politics. It's our culture, right? And I think that if you talk to the average Vietnamese in Vietnam or the Vietnamese Americans here, government and politics is usually not what that's not what they identify with. There's a very small portion of the society that really is involved in politics, right? So aside from that, I think about for folks that are living in Vietnam, folks that are living here, I think that ultimately what really matters is their life better because of it, right? And I think that if we're able to create educational opportunities for people to come and live and work in the United States or in Vietnam, and to be able to support their families to pursue their dreams, that's ultimately what we should be pursuing. There's going to be different opinions in terms of how we govern, and that exists here in the United States as well, right? I mean, within parties, right? We each party has their own vision of how to run run a government, right? But at the end of the day, we should be looking at our measures of success should be looking at people that we serve. Are we able to create more opportunities for folks? Are we able to provide for a lot of people, provide for their families, and have better outcomes, right? So that should be the true measure of how we, as those of us that are in policy, how we measure our success and how we should gauge what we do, and as we think about cross-Pacific relationships, right?
Looking into the future and thinking about Catherine's role as a commissioner for the Port of Portland, are you ever going to get into politics, Catherine?
She already is. She's already deep in politics already.
That's a hard question. But I'll tell you this. In 2015, we were curious, right? The Port of Portland is our landlord, but why are they going trade mission to Vietnam? So we were so curious. That's why we're like, now that we are one of the stakeholder as small business, we just want to see and, quite frankly, to learn. And so we were able to join the 2015 trade mission to Vietnam, led by our former Governor Brown. And during the trip, we really we had a chance to meet with other state holders, state agency, and we, we were just learning, and we also had the chance to sit in a few of important meetings. Daniel and I went with the mentality to just learn, and why, right? Why is our landlord, Port of Portland, involved in this trade? But we didn't know they were the economic engine for the state. So fast forward, during the a few conversations of inviting me to be at the policy level representing small businesses, which we have experienced through our own business, the challenges and how to maneuver some of that barriers. So therefore, I accepted the appointment in 2018 to serve on their commission.
That's the Business Oregon Commission.
Well, 2016 was the Business Oregon Commission, and then 2018 was the appointment with the Port of Portland. And now I'm serving on a second term. Each term is 4 years. This is my first year of a second term on their leadership, which is as their treasurer at the Portland Commission.
This is amazing. You know, I really just got to touch upon certain things with each one of you in this joint in, you know, podcast, but I hope that I can have a full podcast session with each one of you in the future, in the near future. And I want to thank you both for, you know, coming on to the podcast today. It was a treat for me because I'd been really wanting to sit with you both. But I do, I want to express that I want to sit with both of you and have a full, you know, because there's a journey here that we need to explore. And when the young people listen and the audience sometimes skews, depending on who the guests are, young people listen and they get inspired and they write to me and they're like, oh my God, I had no idea this was happening in Oregon or, you know, in Alaska or Louisiana. You know, these things, these stories from individuals like yourselves really serve to inspire and educate the rest of us. So thank you both for coming on today.
It's an honor. Well, thank you.
It's an honor. Thank you for listening to our stories.
Of course. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.